actually, you've heard this in hermeneutics from me. The Old Testament guys don't even do text criticism, so it doesn't matter. And almost being a PhD is sort of like being almost married or almost having a pay raise. We'll leave it at that. Well, I don't know about you guys, but given the title of the session after lunch here today, I was sort of expecting a paper on the Old Testament. What I got instead was what Jesus and the Sadducees and the apostles were doing, and not a whole lot of Old Testament. In other words, we sort of ended up where we were this morning with nothing but stories, and what kind of spin you put on the story, and how persuasive your story is. Now, I will let you guys attack Tim on this. I happen to agree completely with what he did, and so I'm not going to... I'm not going to take him to task. I will present a couple things that I think Tim needs to answer for us, and him rather than me. First of all, is all we are really left with then a conversation with ourself? We know the outcome. We know the answer in Christ. Is that all we can kind of do is talk about that story amongst ourselves because we sort of already agree what to do with these texts? The second thing is sort of related. Should we therefore simply revel in this individuality or this interpretive playground that we have here? And you've got a story, I've got a story, and we all got stories, and ain't that great, sort of a thing. I hope you guys really kind of realize how different what Tim is doing here with the Old Testament is from what, as Paul pointed out, you find in Chemnitz or the classic Lutheran dogmatic tradition, which tried to find passages that proved that Israel thought the same thing we did about the resurrection, that when Abraham put his son Isaac up on the altar, he was able to do so because he knew he would see Isaac in heaven again. This is a very different approach and one I think is very helpful, but I'll let you guys chew Tim apart a little bit on this. What I would like to do here briefly is maybe step back a little bit and reflect on perhaps... we should do a little bit more of what Israel did with resurrection. Because as Tim describes it, they weren't thinking of resurrection merely in terms of, gee, I get to go to heaven, but that the people of God would endure, that God would continue to save his people in history, in time, no matter what happens, that individuals would die, even receive judgment, Solomon, David, even Moses' life is cut short by God because he messed up, but Israel goes on. You see, Israel rises from the dead in the flood, in the Exodus, in the exile, in the remnant, and finally in the man, Jesus Christ. And this Jesus, of course, is Israel. Israel reduced to one, as you learn in your Synoptic Gospels classes. Indeed, we should even say that Jesus did what Israel could not do. He rises from the dead. Not merely he lives a sinless life like Israel could not, but Israel could not come back to life apart from God's action, could not bodily, as an individual, come back to life, and so Jesus does so. Tim quoted 1 Corinthians 15, which I admit to reading in a new way because of this context. Paul writes, For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. Now listen to that again. By a man has come the resurrection of the dead. In other words, it wasn't there before. It didn't exist before. Maybe even no one had thought of it before. No one could conceive of it before. And certainly no one could experience it before. But Jesus did. He was raised, and in so doing, he invented the resurrection of the dead. And for this reason, Paul is able to argue that Christ is the first fruits, and that we will certainly not precede him in resurrection because, well, it didn't exist before Christ. And apart from him, there is no resurrection. But I wonder this, and this is where Israel helps, I think. Have we, in our desire to get ourselves to heaven, lost a bit of Israel's perspective and even trust in God's resurrection. What we might learn from Israel is that the survival of the community is more important than my survival. That God's people continue to exist by God's power. That children for Abraham continue to be raised up, even from stones if necessary. And that is, frankly, more important than what happens to me. This would explain Paul's debating in the letter to the Philippians whether or not he should live or die. He desires to live, but only so that the Philippians might be strengthened. And the early martyrs of our faith had the same hope. Read Polycarp of Smyrna, or Tertullian's Concerning Flight and Persecution, or even Origen's Exhortation to Martyrdom, where they don't argue that Christians shouldn't worry about martyrdom because they're going to go to heaven anyway. They argue that martyrdom of the individual strengthens the community of believers. Origen, in fact, a couple of times uses the striking image of the arena and that the entire church in heaven and on earth is watching to see what our confession will be. And will they go home from that event strengthened in faith, encouraged to live their lives of faith, or will they go home uncertain of Christ's promises of God's presence with them? That's an amazing treatise. See, they argue that the martyrdom of the individual strengthens, as I said, the community. And so a confession, a martyrion, is made, and the confession of the martus strengthen those who must continue to endure, carrying on the faith by the power of God until Christ does return. And so we end up where Tim quite appropriately did, with nothing left to do but confess and praise the one who brings resurrection. Confess him before men. Not merely because I'm going to heaven, but because through my witness, whether I live or die, God's people are built up, strengthened, and indeed raised up. Thanks, Tim, for a challenging and stimulating paper.